For MeatPoultry.com, I'm Joel Cruz, editor. Meat and poultry processing is an essential part of not only producing food for people, but also the pets they love. It is this common ground that was the premise for Sawzen Publishing Company, the parent company of Meat and Poultry, to launch Pet Food Processing magazine about 4 years ago. Indeed, the processing of meat, poultry, and seafood is similar in many ways, whether for people or pets. And many of the challenges, opportunities, and even consumer behaviors in the market are reflected in the operations of processing plants. For this week's Meat Poultry Podcast, we spoke to the editor of Pet Food Processing, Jennifer Simple, about the genesis of one of Sawzen's newest titles and why the time was right for an operationally focused pet food and pet treat industry publication. Since its launch, the community of pet food processors and suppliers have shown overwhelming support for the publication, its website, and other digital offerings. With many overlapping processes, food safety considerations, and regulatory requirements, Jennifer talked about the growth of the industry and some of the operational attributes pet food and treat processors share with the traditional meat and poultry processors. Take a listen as Jennifer discusses the growing role of pet food and pet treat production in what is a multi-billion dollar industry. This podcast may leave you begging for more. All right. Welcome, everyone. We want to thank Jennifer Simple for joining the Meat and Poultry Podcast to talk about a food segment that overlaps a lot with the meat and poultry processing industry in terms of processes and regulatory compliance, things like equipment that's used, and even consumer and consumption trends. And that segment is pet food and pet treat processing. And specifically, we're talking about our the sister publication, Pet Food Processing, which Jennifer is the editor of. So welcome, Jennifer. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Joel. I'm happy to be here.
So we'll just jump right in. Let's talk a little bit about Pet Food Processing Magazine and just a little bit about the industry. Given the growth in pet ownership and just the pet industry in general in recent years, the launch of Pet Food Processing was obviously the right new magazine at the right time for Sawzen, and as a sister publication to Meat and Poultry, the magazine's been published for 4 years, correct?
Yes. Yep. We're on our fourth year right now.
So, do you want to talk a little bit about how the magazine concept was kind of developed and the evolution and kind of the response to the magazine from the market and and having a magazine with an operational focus, kind of like Meat and Poultry kind of does. That tends to be our focus as well. And maybe talk a little bit about some numbers and overall, the size of market, that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. So we launched the magazine in 2018, and the push for that really came from strong supplier relationships that Sawzen Publishing had in the meat and poultry industry, like you mentioned, but also in baking and snack industry and in the grain industry. So the pet food and treat industry has grown every year for the last 10 years, including during the pandemic. So, a lot of attention has turned to this industry because of that sustained growth and because it overlaps so many of these other human food industry processing areas. So the overall U.S. pet care industry just reached a milestone in 2020 and surpassed $100 billion in sales. And food and treats make up for about $42 billion of that. So, it's a large growing industry. And manufacturing of pet food and treats is, really a complex process that, similar to other food processing that goes on in meat and baking and, other stuff in the human food processing area. But we just felt like there was a need in the market for in-depth discussions on the complexities of making and delivering safe pet food and treats. And we've been fortunate that, you know, experts in the industry saw the opportunity we offered to share their knowledge on topics specific to formulation and manufacturing, production, process efficiency, automation, and food safety.
Awesome. Yeah. Again, it was well timed, I think, and it's been well received. So during that first year, 4 years ago, the magazine started out being quarterly with a website and some newsletters that followed. Can you kind of talk about the evolution of the brand and the response and the support of that processing and the supplier community for the magazine? And also, if you could maybe talk a little bit about the role that social media is played in that growth and kind of developing that community and that kind of the ongoing give and take among readers and their suppliers.
Yeah, sure. So in the first year, we produced just 4 quarterly print issues, and we didn't launch the website or the newsletters until a year after that. So our first focus was print and really kind of taking a deep dive into the processing topics that were unique to pet food processors and some of the more technical topics like bioavailability of certain nutrients in the pet diets and some topics like that. So after we started the website, you know, we also started social media, and the goal of that was to kind of increase our reach. And since then, we've added a 5th print issue, which is our resource guide, and we've also added additional newsletters. But both processors and suppliers have been very supportive and open to weighing in on topics that we cover. And the processors in particular have been open to letting us visit their facilities and learn about how the different pet food formats and treat formats are manufactured. And that has been a huge help to us on the editorial side to learn what the challenges are and the important issues related to processing, which hopefully helps us provide content that's useful to those, you know, in this industry. And the engagement, you know, we have fostered on social media, particularly in LinkedIn, it helps us grow our reach, of course, but also that's where processors and suppliers have the opportunity to interact. So we have a following of more than 7,000 on LinkedIn right now, and that, as part of that audience, we have launched a group page recently to be more of a platform where members can contribute their own posts and they can start their own conversations. And, you know, and our hope with that is really to be a resource to the industry. That's an important aspect of Soslin Publishing's culture, is that, you know, that every industry we serve, we also look for ways that we can support the industry, you know, not just be taking content topics from it constantly, but be contributing members of the industry. So, you know, we're looking to do that with our involvement with different associations and also just fostering that kind of communication through our social media channels in the industry is the hope of what that's doing.
So yeah, you kind of hit on some of the topics I was going to ask about next, as far as like editorial goals, and I know for our industry there's never any shortage of topics, and a lot of people will ask, how do you come up with new topics, and you know, how do you stay, you know, relevant? And I assume it's the same for you guys as it is for the meat processing industry, in terms of there's always a regulatory topic to discuss, or an operational or technology, a new technology or a food safety issue that's a hot topic. And so those news and trends aren't as hard to find as you might think. So would you agree that you guys have kind of have that same kind of approach, or are there editorial goals that you set out to achieve, and how are those going, I guess is the question.
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously, with everyone at Soslin being new to the pet food and the treat industry, the most important goal first was gaining an understanding of the industry. And, you know, we knew that it was important to build relationships in the industry as well. But, you know, the desire to constantly offer relevant content that's addressing the challenges and opportunities in the industry is ongoing. And, you know, the degree at which we've been able to do it is simply, you know, from the cooperation of both the suppliers and the processors in the industry and their willingness and understanding that, and a lot of topics, you know, obviously food safety is one you hear all the time where people say that's not a competitive advantage, food safety. You know, knowledge should be shared across industries to benefit everyone because it helps the whole industry. But there's a lot of other areas like that as well that impact the reputation of the industry. And suppliers and processors have recognized the importance of, you know, addressing some of the more challenging in-depth topics in the industry. And therefore, they cooperate with us. They take time out of their busy schedules to, you know, help us provide the content that is relevant, and we hope that it, you know, continues to stay relevant. So I think in the past, kind of the evolution of our publication and how it's been embraced, I think in the past the pet food industry was considered closer to animal feed than to human food production, and it operated a little bit under the radar. But with the consistent growth in the industry and the elevation of the pet as a member of the family and the food safety regulations that were introduced to the industry with the Food Safety Modernization Act, these have all like elevated the awareness of the industry and elevated the importance of the industry to share knowledge. So, you know, we've been welcomed by the industry as a resource to share some of this more in-depth information on the challenges of processing pet food and treats. And, you know, we owe the relevance of our content to the, you know, the kindness and the support of the industry willing to share it.
And obviously a big part of that sharing includes kind of the ultimate example of that is when they invite you to come in their facilities and tour their facilities. And obviously, like us, you all have an operational focus on pet food and pet treat processing, and you guys are always, you know, looking out for the next possible plant tour where you can see things, you know, up close and personal as far as operations go and walking through plants with the principals of the company. So I'm curious, like looking back at say the first plant that you toured, were there things that you recall or that really stood out to you, like kind of surprised you or that you didn't expect to see, or that something that really stuck with you and now has kind of become old hat as you see more plants?
Well, I really think I expected pet food processing plants to be different than human food processing plants, but I found them to be very similar with, you know, the same emphasis on food safety and prevention of cross-contamination. You know, I've been to several meat processing plants in the past, and I've seen the same or better safety protocols and zoning in many of the pet food plants that I've toured. And I've seen a lot of the same equipment used. What surprised me in general with pet food processing is the unique challenge they have to produce food that is a complete and balanced diet, since many pets, you know, will eat just that one type of food for their many years or even their lifetime. And that food needs to supply all the nutrients that pet requires to be healthy. I think this adds a level of complexity to the formulating and processing that I don't think exists in the human food space as much.
Now, let's take a brief time out to remind you to check out the June issue of Meat and Poultry. June means it's time for Meat and Poultry's annual barbecue report, where we showcase the culture and craft of the industry's barbecue segment. In this issue, we spotlight famous pitmasters, iconic eateries, and the can't-miss considerations for food safety. The cover story introduces readers to the mentors who are leading Kingsford's efforts to preserve the history and contributions of Black pitmasters while paving the way for future grill masters. Also in this issue, explore carcass chilling options for poultry processors, and don't miss the exclusive one-on-one interview with Cargill's protein leader, John Nash. and Steve Kay's mid-year industry update. All this and much more are in the June issue of Meat and Poultry. Now let's get back to the podcast.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'd forgotten that you had, previous to your life at Sauslin, you were in the food industry before. So, and we talked a lot about some of the similarities between the, you know, traditional meat and poultry processing plants for, obviously, for human consumption, and those processes that, those operations that process meat and poultry products for pets. There's obviously some longtime advertisers and some suppliers that have supported meat and poultry that were very enthusiastic and happy to have a, you know, somewhere to talk about and to showcase their services and products for the pet food industry. Can you talk a little bit? So there's been that overlap. Can you talk a little bit about the overlap between the two industry in terms of the supply chain, the processing equipment suppliers, and even the supply for raw materials, that kind of thing? You talk a little bit about food safety, but all those things that go into meat and poultry processing also applies to pet food as well, ingredients and on down the line. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. There is a lot of overlap between meat and poultry processing and for human consumption and the processing for pet food. So I see that, you know, I see that a lot in the majority of the new plant construction that has gone on in the last couple of years. You know, that really a large portion of the plant investments that I've seen have been focused on increasing the fresh meat processing and handling capabilities. You know, because the industry focus has been on increasing the fresh meat content of the pet food formulas. So, you know, sometimes this emphasis on fresh meat competes with the raw material supply chain serving the human food industry, but often the raw material supply chain serving the pet food industry includes the co-products from the human food manufacturing side. So, you know, that makes pet food be a really key partner in the sustainability story for meat and poultry processing, actually for a lot of grain processing as well and other ingredients, often because the pet food side uses a co-product, it makes that story, you know, really support the sustainability of the human side of the pet food. So, you know, even though there's processors out there on the pet side that are focused on human food only ingredients and may compete, those tend to be kind of a smaller portion of the market. And the larger portion really, you know, helps the human food side be a full circle processing part of, you know, sustainability. So, and on the equipment side, I see a lot of the same systems from grinding, blending, portioning, forming, and then cooking. You know, there's a lot of the same pieces of equipment that are used in human food processing are used on the pet food side. And ingredients and processing aids are also very simple. But again, sometimes there's, you know, if nothing else on the pet side, a lot of times the ingredients can be stricter because they have to have FDA approval to be used in animal food or as an animal food ingredient. And that process sometimes can take years for certain ingredients to be approved. So even though it might be already approved safe for humans, it has to go through completely separate approval process and studies and proof that it's safe on the animal food side. So, you know, although humans want to see a lot of the same ingredients in their pet food, sometimes there's a delay in that, you know, for the processing. So, and on the packaging side, I think pet food manufacturers face a lot of the same challenges that CPG manufacturers face. They have a lot of product SKUs, a really wide range of product packaging sizes. The durability of the packaging has to withstand the retail environments, e-commerce environments, which are different, And then they have to also just support the, you know, the overall shelf life of the product, which in a pet food can be, you know, up to 24 months. So there's a lot of demands in that area, again, that are really similar across a lot of the human food processing bases.
Yeah, and kind of in that same vein, there's a lot of, obviously there's a lot of traditional meat and poultry processors, processing companies that are involved in the their business, a good part of their business is in the pet food segment, and they kind of quietly do that on the side in a lot of cases. And there's companies like Pilgrim's Pride and Cargill and Simmons Foods, and until recently Tyson before they divested some of their Petri's business. But how do you see those two, you know, the meat and poultry processing for human food versus the, you know, the supply chain and the companies that are in the pet food industry? How do you see them coexisting?
I think there's a lot of room for all of these companies to coexist because, you know, the industry is growing, and a lot of what we're seeing companies do, again, like the Simmons, the Cargills, they're already producing product for humans. And so it's kind of a natural part of their business to go to the pet food side so that they can use as much of the meat products that they process as possible, have as little as waste as possible. But also for companies like Cargill with their new Chompery line of treats, they're selling it, they intend to sell it in the meat aisle of the grocery store. So, you know, a lot of what we're seeing is new products that are coming on the market, they are being targeted to specific segments of the market where humans are, and maybe there's not as many pet treats in that space that, you know, the REIs or the meat aisle of the grocery store. We don't anticipate going there and finding pet treats right now, but Cargill, you know, places a lot of their products in there. So they're already there, they're already placing products there. It's maybe not that big of a leap for them to pet, you know, to place a pet food product there. So, but as far as for some of the larger players like the Purina and Mars, they do a fabulous job of, you know, meeting the customer of all different customers wanting all different product, from the value product to the premium product. They do a good job of meeting them wherever they are. And on the pet food side, it is just a much larger leap to get into the food side versus the treat side, just simply because the food, it's a formulation challenge that it must meet all of the pet's nutrient needs. So on the treat side, you know, you see a lot more new products coming into the treat side, but there's a lot more willingness on the pet part, in the pet parent part, to try new products and to treat them with new products, where it's a big ask for a pet owner to switch the food for their pet. But if you happen to be a brand that someone is feeding to their pet, they also are really reluctant to move away from you. So there's a lot of benefits on the food side, but it is just a larger challenge on the food part. But on the treat part, it seems that there's you know, no end to the amount of treats that pet parents are willing to try and willing to purchase at different locations. So it's a growing market. I see there just being a lot of room for all of these new brands to compete successfully.
Yeah, I'm glad you made that distinction between pet food processing versus pet treat processing. And I think you guys distinguish that very well in the magazine as well. So, so when the magazine launched, you know, none of us clearly had any idea that, you know, 3 years later, there would be a global pandemic, and that's affected, you know, clearly it affected the meat and poultry industry and every other food industry, including pet food processing. So we saw lots of bottlenecks. We realized how fragile our food supply chain was on the meat and poultry side. What were some of the challenges that the the pet food industry faced during the pandemic and continues to.
Well, a lot of the same things like you mentioned, and you know, right off the bat, the pet food industry experienced the same like pantry loading, pantry loading push by the pet owners that really strained their processing at the same time that they were trying to, you know, ensure that all their employees were safe. One thing I think in the pet industry that maybe is a little bit different than the meat and poultry industry is that I don't think, from my experience of going in plants, they don't have as many areas that have a high number of employees in a small space. So for the most part, they have pretty low density of the staff throughout the plant, with the exception of packaging. The packaging area takes quite a few more people in that area, especially just with the variety of packaging that has to be delivered by the processor. We didn't see nearly as many closings, I don't think, due to COVID that the meat processing industry did. But because of the high demand and, you know, possibly because of suppliers having to close or having to have fewer employees per shift to allow for social distancing among the employees, there was some supplier issues, here and there in different areas. And I think one of the things that a lot of processors realize, especially the larger ones, you know, they had found their favorite supplier and stuck with that one supplier on a national level. And when things got tight, they weren't as nimble and flexible. So I did have one very large processor talk about the fact that, you know, they were kind of forced to tell each processing location to find an alternate source sometimes for a supplier. And that, you know, after they had that process and this, you know, more local supplier to the local processing plant, after they had kind of saved the processors. But the last thing this national processor wanted to do is stop all of those local relationships again and go back to national, that they felt like it kept them more nimble and flexible to let each location kind of have their own local sources of things, and it allowed more future flexibility. So I think there was a lot learned in that way. There's been a big shift. There already was a big shift before the pandemic towards e-commerce sales versus going to a brick and mortar in-person store. And that shift only accelerated during the pandemic. So a lot of brands were having to either, you know, quickly adapt so that they could offer e-commerce or expand, you know, the e-commerce offerings that they had. And Chewy's, who is one of the largest online pet care retailers, they reported that the growth curves that they saw, the company had expected to see those curves play out over several years, and that they were compressed into quarters or even months. So it was a big jump forward as far as pet owners' willingness to shop and purchase products, you know, online. So right now, they're expecting by 2024, I think, that e-commerce will account for about 35% of the sales in the U.S. for pet food and treats. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's quite a big shift. And there were definitely some other shortages, notable shortages, particularly in canned pet food. And that was, like a lot of things, it was not just any attributed to one thing. It was a combination of things. So a lot of canned pet food for the cats, especially if they include fish items, a lot of those are processed overseas at the source where the fish are processed for human food. And so there was some international shipping backlogs and some difficulty in getting products. One processor said, you know, their product was in the U.S., but because there was such a backlog of shipment at the ports, they couldn't physically get to it and bring it in. And there also was a shift because so many parents were spending time at home with their pets. They paid more attention to what the pet was eating and making mealtime a little bit more of an, you know, enjoyable or variety experience. And so, you know, prior to the pandemic, there was a shift we saw with combining maybe a dry pet food with a wet topper or a broth or, you know, freeze-dried products, but, you know, supplementing dry pet food with other types of formats of products. And that continued during the pandemic, and wet pet foods, dog foods and cat foods both experienced pretty good growth during the pandemic. And that kind of has created some shortages in the canned pet food, but there is some pretty significant processing investments going on in the U.S. that should increase the canned manufacturing capacity in the U.S. in the next year or so. So hopefully that'll help solve that.
Yeah. So in closing, one other question or topic I thought would be interesting to hear from you on is well, before and during the and even now, pre and post pandemic, there's been a big push, as you mentioned at the very beginning, in terms of spending habits, as far as people, pet parents, what they spend on their pets, not just for food, but just in general, pampering and caring for their pets like they would their kids in many cases. And now there's pet food and pet treats out there that are functional, you know, have a functional purpose and a, you know, not just feeding your pet, but also doing something beyond that to in terms of health and wellness or diet or age or joint formulas or that kind of thing for all types of situations and breeds. Can you talk a little bit about those trends and kind of how that parallels kind of how people's eating patterns sometimes are reflected in what they feed their pets?
You're exactly right. Yeah, a lot of the pet offerings are focusing on functional benefits, like you mentioned, you know, joint health and longevity, same kind of things that a human might be concerned about for themselves. So it absolutely, the pet space mirrors the human space on a lot of these wellness trends, primarily because the human is the one who decides what's best for their pets. And that's a challenge, I think, that's really unique to this industry, because brands have to, you know, to be successful, they have to meet the needs of the human in order for the product to be purchased. But then they also have to appeal to the pet once that product is purchased. So it's, you know, sometimes a big ask to meet both those customers' needs with the same single product. So, and like I said before, you know, the pandemic has only increased, I think, people's focus on the health and well-being of their pets, because they've become, you know, they're there all day. They become an important daily companion, or, you know, or even coworker. So, and that's made the human pet owner focus more on the experience, I think, the eating, dining, and treating experience for the pet. So, in some ways, you know, I think that you know, what people feed their pets faces more scrutiny than what they feed themselves. Because I had, as you know, one processor pointed out to me on this, that it's probably easier to put your pet on a healthy diet than it is to stick to one yourself. So, yeah. You know, we're seeing a lot of the same things: grain free, organic, non-GMO,
plant based. You know,
plant, absolutely. We're seeing the plant-based. We're seeing the, you know, lab-generated protein ingredients, insects. The insects, I think, will be an area insect protein might be an area that gains traction quicker in pets than in humans, because I could see humans being a little bit more willing to feed their pets insect protein, maybe before they're willing to eat it themselves. But we'll have to see how that goes.
Very good. All right. Well, this is an interesting topic, and it's really great for us to kind of look at these two industries and how similar they are and they're different. I mean, there's lots of parallels and lots of differences as well, but hopefully we can do this on an ongoing basis with pet food processing. And since we are sister publications with you all, it's always a good opportunity to kind of talk about common ground. So we appreciate you being with us today, and we will stay in touch. And we thank everyone for listening to the podcast.
Yeah, great. Thanks for your time, Joel. Enjoyed talking to you.
Make sure to check out the latest monthly features for Meat and Poultry's print edition and stay on top of daily industry news online at meatpoultry.com. Also, follow us on social media on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram, all by searching at Meat Poultry. And if you liked or didn't like what you heard, or if you have suggestions for future topics or guests, please leave us a rating and review. Your feedback is really valuable as we develop future podcast topics. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.